Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We have John Gentry out of Tennessee. He's running for governor that we're going to have an interview with. And so we kind of modified the whole layout, schedule, promos, and everything else. What we are going to be talking about is really his getting involved in the First Amendment petition. He is a huge First Amendment petition advocate. He's very similar to Bob Schultz. We've never been able to get Bob Schultz onto the show, but we've introduced you to some of the stuff he's done and worked with him on some petitions. And so in the state of Tennessee, Mr. Gentry has actually utilized the First Amendment petition, and he's actually been successful. And I'm telling you that these are teeth in the Constitution that we have to start using. We have to start using what we would call these weapons that are available to us in the Constitution. So what we're going to do is I'm going to basically go through the obligatories in the next 5 minutes, and then we're going to go to a break. And then as soon as that break's over, we're going to go straight into that interview. Now, we used Zoom. I'm not sure how many people have used a lot of different conferencing calls. But Zoom, since everybody uses video and everybody has migrated over to Zoom, especially since the pandemic and this overutilization of, you know, communicating in distance communications, that bottom line is we had some dropouts, but they're not really substantial. And it doesn't mean that you can't figure out, you know, what he probably said or what have you. They're just some small little dropouts. And instead of, you know, living with that, because, I mean, when you watch interviews on TV or what have you, you can tell there's a little dropout. And instead of going back, I felt that it was just best to kind of let the conversation have its own volition. So if you don't hear something and then it kind of continues on, don't worry, you're not really missing too much. You should be able to connect all the dots out of this conversation. You should be able to start understanding the importance of what needs to be done and why we need to be doing these things. With that, let me tell you that this show is also sponsored by republicreview.org. And this is the only show that dives into the academic evidence and the evidence-based solutions of what needs to happen. We have a comment line, 425-270-5416. And I still need to get with Charles. I haven't been able to, I've been just really busy. Charles, I know you're probably listening, so please forgive me. We will get together so we can talk about the issue regarding bankruptcy and student loans and so forth. Anyway, there's a lot of other things that are going on in the news, but we need to dive into content. And we're really at this point where we need to start diving into this content so that we can start providing you a strategy of what you can do so that we can start winning in the elections in 2022 and take a bigger bite out of the rhinos and swing things towards the Constitution instead of towards the party. And so I think in so doing, we are going to win when it comes to fighting for our liberties and fighting for our sovereignty. So as you can tell, and this interview will span two episodes. So it'll be today and tomorrow, because we've basically talked for about an hour and 20 minutes, hour and 30 minutes, something like that. But anywho, this is an important interview. We kind of touch and dive into the weeds on some issues. There's still a lot of things that we need to get into. I really like Mr. Gentry. I think that he's going to be a great leader. And what we want to do is we want to make sure that what we have in, you know, working together is really exploiting the common ground that we have. We have to be able to use every inch of that, the surface of the blade, every inch of that surface of the land that we have a foothold on, so that we can use it to our advantage. So with that, one of the things that I also want to kind of remind you of is that when we get into these resolutions, you're going to want to mark the day, because these are the hardcore arguments for Republic Review. because bottom line, Republic Review was just a label of marketing that was really placed upon what Madison and Jefferson did. And instead of leaving it into ambiguity, we decided, in working with Douglas V. Gibbs out of California, the Constitution Association, he said, well, you got to call this something. And so that's when the name came out. And as I told you, this is enough of the Republic to use political force. Republic Review is where we have enough of the Republic, which is 27 states, to use political force to force the federal government into compliance. We have the ability to do this. And I believe every red-blooded American wants to see that Constitution saved as well as their liberty saved. And I believe that the majority of the people, when they start realizing what everything else means, that they would much rather be on the side of the Constitution than on the side of whatever government they're going to want to inject into our everyday lives. Please, please let other people know the content that we're providing, the direction, and the help that we're actually giving, so that anybody and everybody out there that is actually looking for opportunities to serve, looking to get involved, because we need to start getting people ready now. We need to develop and nurture those people who are going to challenge these rhinos, challenge these pseudo-conservatives, challenge these cherry-picking Constitution supporters, those who only support the Second Amendment, those who only support, you know, the health, vaccination, freedoms, and those little types of things that really do nothing to actually get government out of our knickers and back into the framework of the Constitution. So with that, we are going to, like I said, this is just going to be a music break. And as soon as we come back from the music, as soon as the music's over, we're going straight into that interview. So please stand by. We'll be with John Gentry in just a second. Okay. Well, I appreciate you taking the time. And I appreciate the information that you sent me. I did notice that it seems like there's a gap in New Mexico. Is that correct?
In New Mexico?
And Minnesota. There's no First Amendment petitioning in Minnesota. At least the Minnesota line is blank, and the New Mexico line is blank. And, you know, the spreadsheet you sent me.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So those are two states that don't have. Okay, so I'll dive into that later, and I'll want to kind of make this available, because this is great, having this kind of information to share with people that are, you know, wanting, ready to get to pick up arms and take on their government and their representation. So, anywho,
this was the quote I was looking for from Cooley.
Okay.
The right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition government for redress of grievance is one which would seem unnecessary to be expressly provided for in a Republican government, since it results from the very nature and structure of its institutions. It is impossible that it could be practically denied until the spirit of liberty had wholly disappeared and the people had become so servile and debased as to be unfit to exercise any of the privileges of free men. That's where we are. That's where we are today, is it is denied, and the only way that can happen is if we as a people have become so servile and debased that we are unfit to exercise the privileges of free men. As a society, that's where we are. And, you know, my work is about educating the people,
right,
and making fit again to perform their civic duty and begin to oversee government again. That's, you know, that's what my work is about.
Right. So my take on this, and for what it's worth, is that there is some surrendering of sovereignty by the people. However, until the Constitution is changed to remove that from, you know, our rights, from out of the Bill of Rights, or something's taken out of the Constitution, we may not be exercising it. They may not be recognizing it, but that does not mean that that process, the lack of recognition or the lack of use, makes it any less constitutional.
Right. And this, yeah, this is what I'm fighting for in Tennessee. But here's the point I'm making about, you know, Cooley saying that, you know, if this is debased, it's because we're unfit to exercise liberty as free men. Here's what I mean by that. And how that seems very true today is I recently filed a remonstrance signed by citizens from across the entire state of Tennessee. And in that, I'll read, it's very short. I think I emailed a copy of it to you. And it just says, you know, to Representative Garrett, a large number of citizens from across the street assert their right to apply to the powers of government for redress agreements and proper purpose by address. We the people are exercising our constitutional right to orally address the legislative houses. And the speaker is Speaker Sexton, Speaker of the House, is ignoring me. And if you watch the video of the announcement of the remonstrance, the clerk incorrectly state, you know, he said that I wanted to reinstitute the right of petition by address or by address of remonstrance. It's actually by address or. And you could see the speaker smirk when he said of, because he knew that was an unlawful reading of the actual Tennessee Constitution. And you got the speaker scoffing.
Wow.
And people are showing his contempt for the people. And then he refuses, you know, his next step is to invite me and assemble the body and invite me to present this petition to the House. That's his next step, but he is ignoring me. And so, you know, he showed that these legislators are showing absolute contempt for the people. And they're saying, we don't have to uphold your right. And there's nothing you can do about it. There is absolutely nothing you, the people, can do to force me to adhere to the Constitution and to perform my duty under the Constitution and to adhere to my oath. There is nothing you can do about it. You are impotent against me. I control the courts, or we, this oligarchy, we control the courts. We control the law enforcement. We can smother the people, and there's nothing you can do about it. That's where we are. And so, you know, my work now is to try to explain this to my people, that a right, your most powerful right, far more powerful than free speech, more powerful than the right to bear arms, and more precious than the right to practice religion according to our own conscience. It has been stripped from the people, and citizens should be outraged over that. And this is happening across the country, where other patriots like myself are starting to reassert this right in Texas and Florida and New Hampshire. And the legislative houses are mocking this right that is actually, It's the cornerstone. It's the foundation of our constitutional system and our republic. You know, Cooley said it here. The right of the people to assemble and petition would seem unnecessary to be expressly provided in a republican government. Like, why did they even have to make it a right? Of course.
So let me ask you, if you could interrupt. When did Cooley make that statement?
He wrote this book. This book was first written... Let me look at the cover here. So this was, I'm looking at the fifth edition of this. The first printing of this, let me find it here, 1824.
Okay, so the reason why that's important is because that comment, that assertion was made before the unconstitutional establishment of corporations and the movement of our government and system into an unconstitutional structure. And so there's a lot of people that, you know, that don't really, and I'm sure you understand the sovereign citizen movement, correct?
Which, I know of it, and I actually, you know, disagree. Individual citizens are not sovereign. They're not. The sovereignty resides in the people as a whole.
Correct.
Individuals are not, they are not above the law. They are not, they do not hold sovereignty in and of themselves. It is the whole of us. It is all of us, of the people, in which the sovereignty resides, but never an individual.
Well, it's really simple, because they never said the person, they said the people. People means plural. It means the body of the assembled people. And so, yeah, I get that. But the sovereign citizen movement is banking on this concept that this is a legitimate perversion of our government, when it's absolutely a violent violation of the Constitution. The states never delegated to the federal government the ability to create corporations to actually be able to funnel money to a foreign state and to subjugate the United States, because bottom line, there's nowhere, as George Nicholas declared during the ratification debates, that the federal government cannot enter into a treaty without having the enumerated powers to do so. If they did, it would be repugnant and a violation of the Constitution. So in other words, if they created a treaty to do something that they had no enumerated powers for, like if you want to say with the UN, surrendering our rights to bear arms, or going into taking on debt to spend on something that they have no authority to spend on, like health care, or anything like that. All of these things are defrauding the American people, whether it is through debt.
And you're saying,
go ahead.
Yeah, but I would agree, and I think what you're saying is essentially we have a vacant government, because it is not the government of the form and character that was established in our state and federal constitutions, and so because the government has unlawfully altered its form and abandoned its Republican character, you know, everything that the government is doing is void. And I would agree with that, but it is up to the people, you know, and not individuals to correct that problem. I think, you know, the Tennessee Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, power is inherent in the people, and government is instituted to provide for our peace, safety, and happiness.
Correct. Correct.
And to that end, we have an unalienable, and just to clarify, some people think that reads unalienable. It is actually unalienable, and means a lien can't be placed on it. It can't be sold. It can't be transferred. It's unalienable and indefeasible right to reform, alter, or abolish government in such manner as they think proper, may think proper. But that's, you know, that's from the people as a whole. Right. That's not as an individual. Although, you know, if I can't get round with the people, I think I am. But if I couldn't get ground, I think I would test that theory myself and maybe, you know, go up to the speaker and just give him a good sock in the stomach in the solar plexus and say, you know, I'm here to reform you because you're oppressing my right to address the body. And, of course, you know, that would result in battery charges. And I think I could defend that very well in a court of law, saying I was asserting my unalienable, indefeasible right to reform, alter, or abolish. And I think that's a whole lot better than taking up arms to go in there and give them a punch in the gut.
Sure, right. Well, so you're correct. The process, we have to actually take back the states. And the state, what we need are people that will occupy the sovereign body of the state government, which is the state legislature, and get them to actually take up the action of and the responsibility of the overseers of the compact. See, the beautiful thing about the Constitution is that the states being the parties, they are a perpetual entity. So even though they may have shed form and have taken on this unconstitutional standing, it doesn't mean that the states can't get fixed and actually get back engaged into their compact, enforcing the federal government into compliance. Because did you get a chance to read Madison's notes on nullification that I sent you?
No, I haven't had a chance.
That's okay. We'll kind of meander through some of that. But what I'd like to talk first about is what got you involved in this. So I know you're a fellow brethren in the Marine Corps, and you served some time, and so you got out of the Marine Corps, and I guess you couldn't find a job that would, you know, require the type of, you know, bringing down hostile fire upon your competitors. So you got a different type of job. So what did you do when you got out of the Marine Corps and got you going in this direction into understanding government and understanding our constitutional rights?
After the Marine Corps, I went to college. I completed my bachelor's degree in 2.5 years, and I became a licensed certified public accountant, passed the CPA exam for the first time, graduated cum laude from the University of Maryland. I don't practice as an accountant today, so I don't have a current license, but I was first time pass on the CPA exam. And I was like everybody else. I really was. I was ignorant. You know, I thought that the United States was the greatest country in the world and that, you know, everybody else has corruption, but not us. That was my belief. I had no clue. And I just went through family court proceedings where I experienced a tremendous amount of corruption, violating my right to be heard, my right to present evidence. Just denying me due process across the board. And I was not willing to accept that, you know, that I could be bullied and harassed by a judge. And so I sought remedy, you know, through the state courts and the federal courts. And especially as I went through the federal courts, I was like, man, they're just as corrupt. And so I took these two cases all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. I now have three cases docketed on the Supreme Court of the United States, and they're corrupt. You know, the entire judiciary, top to bottom, is absolutely corrupt. And you know, when you take two cases to the Supreme Court of the United States, you know, it's like, well, where do you go from there? And working with other colleagues, you know, it was suggested, you know, if we're not getting justice in this one branch of government, let's try the legislative branch. And so that's where I started doing the research, and I learned about the right of petition, the right of remonstrance, and have really immersed myself because it literally, everything that is wrong in this country is because this right is oppressed. So I have absolutely immersed myself into the scholarly study of this right and the history of this right. I'm probably the top expert in this country right now on the history and the exercise of this right. So as I started going to the legislative houses, it's like, these guys are corrupt too, because a lot of the statutes that they're creating protect the corruption that's going on in the judiciary. And so I realized, wow, our legislative houses are largely just as corrupt as our judicial branch. And so then it's like, well, you know, what do you do? What do you do then? And you know, the answer is you have to get the people behind you, beside you.
So could I ask? So if I could ask, what was the first thing that got you engaged or passionate or taking a stand on this very specific thing
about the right of petition?
Yeah. Uh-huh. What was that? What was it? What was the case? What was the issue that, you know, got you so engaged to say, you know what, I'm going to become the foremost expert. I am going to, you know, get to understand this, and I'm going to use this as a weapon.
Oh, well, yeah, well, that's easy. There's two things, essentially. In the words of Abraham Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address, that we cannot consecrate or desecrate this ground anymore, and I'm paraphrasing here, any more than these men, and that we here highly resolve that these men shall have not died in vain, and that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. I serving in the military, lost friends. And I have a great respect for what the men in uniform have done for this country, establishing it in the Revolutionary War and preserving and protecting this republic, you know, throughout our history. And I refuse to accept that everything that we fought for no longer exists. I refuse to accept that. So that, you know, that was, you know, even though it was just, you know, a denial of due process in my case, it's due process is constitutional right. It's what we, you know, it's fundamental also, you know, to our form of government, justice. That was, you know, in preamble of the Declaration or of the Constitution, we the people in order to form a more perfect union and establish justice. That's why we created this republic, was to provide justice. So I refuse to accept, you know, that the men and women have sacrificed in vain. And the other piece is, as I got involved in this and I started learning about the corruption, and the biggest one that gets me is children taken wrongfully under color of law. It is so wrong on so many levels. It is the greatest evil in this country. The Child Protective Services, the foster care system, it is the source of child trafficking and prostitution in this country. It is the supply chain.
So let me ask you this, because you used a term that I really haven't gotten into, because it hasn't come up in, because it wasn't a part of the constitutional ratification debates or, you know, the very beginning of the founding of this nation from the framers. They never used the term color of law. They may have, but it's not in any of the documents and such that I referred to. So I've not seen it. So when you use that term, I'd like my listeners to understand, what does the color of law mean? Can you explain
that? It means
that?
It appears to be lawful, but okay. It's actually unlawful. So, you know, statutorily, it appears what they're doing is correct, but the statutes are actually repugnant to state or federal constitutions. That's one aspect of color of law. Color of law is also when you have proceedings that appear to be according, you know, to due process, you know, that appear to be providing due process.
Right.
There's actually a lot of case steering going on, right, and bias in the judge. And so, you know, it looks like that everything is being done fair, but it's actually not. It's complete denial of due process and a perversion of justice. So those are the two aspects of color of law.
Right. And so for me to inject for my listeners, anything, because the federal government has usurped this power because they've never been delegated the power to regulate labor. In 1926, Calvin Coolidge, who was an advocate for the amendment, you know, went out and championed this amendment that was submitted to the states to allow the federal government to regulate child labor. And the states rejected it. So the states have never, through the codified or through the systematic process in the United States Constitution, they never delegated any authority to the federal government to have any touching of or any ability to regulate labor at all. And so they've now created the Department of Labor. They started creating labor laws, and they've got themselves all entangled in this facade of labor and labor law. And so everything that is tied to that entire webbing of labor law in this country is the color of law.
Absolutely. And let me give you a breakdown on why that has happened. It comes from the legal profession and the judiciary. You know, in 1821, Thomas Jefferson said the dissolution of our federal government lies in the power of the judiciary, an irresponsible body, working like gravity, by night and by day, gaining a little today and a little tomorrow, like a thief over the field of jurisdiction, until all shall render powerless the check of one branch over the other, and shall become as venal and oppressive as the government from which we separated. So Jefferson, and he anticipated it in 1821, that the judicial branch and the legal profession is what is going to tear this country apart, because they're, you know, they've always been that way. Hamilton, Federalist 83, magistrates are easily corrupted, and that's why we have a right to a trial by jury. You know, when you look at the Constitution, you have a right to a trial by jury, and you have a right of due process. Those protections are because magistrates are easily corrupted. That's why they. That's why we have a right to a trial by jury, and it's why we have a right of due process, is because they know judges are easily corrupted. So here's what happened. Starting in the 1960s, the legal profession came up with the time is money concept. Prior to that, around 1949 and up until the 50s, an attorney charged their client based on the service that they provided, the client's ability to pay, and whether they were successful in the case or not. And that was what that was how, and they were called lawyers. There weren't attorneys back then, I don't think. But that was how they billed their clients. And the education level for most of them was equivalent to a plumber, really. I mean, they didn't have formal education, but many of them. In the 1960s, the big law firms in Chicago started coming out with the time is money concept. And when they came out with the time is money concept, it started taking longer for things to get done through the court process. And to make that even more of a bounty for them is they started creating complex rules of procedure. And the reason for the complex rules of procedure is to make less what laypersons can do for themselves, to start establishing a monopoly now. Complicated that process about as much as they can think of. It's like, well, what's next? So now they're going to start creating new torts. The economic theory of this country used to be caveat emptor. It means buyer beware. Don't be a sucker. Do your legwork and figure out whether you're going to buy something or not. Be smart. The legal profession has turned our economic theory upside down, and it's now, manufacturer liability, product liability. And from that, it transformed over to slip and fall, negligent driver. And all of these torts are now new product lines. They're new revenue streams for our legal profession. So they've complicated it. And now they're creating new lines of business with these new torts, with product liability, all these negligence cases. So what's next? Well, the next thing is let's start legislating and let's make new laws so that we can start suing businesses, because businesses are where the merchants, that's where the money is now. So you start creating a Department of Labor and you start having labor laws. Now you've got the whole class action lawsuit coming out of the bag. And that's a whole nother perversion of our legal system. These class action lawsuits are the biggest scam. It is the biggest confidence game in the history of this world. So you've got, attorneys that go out. Here's a prime example. You got attorneys out in California that they go to Billy Bob Joe legislator and they say, hey, let's make a law that employees have to take a meal break in 5 hours. And if they don't, then the employer, even though the meal break's a half hour, if they don't take a meal break, the employer owes them an hour of their time. And and we're going to fine them, so the state government gets a little money too. Then they go around and they place flyers under the windshield wipers of employees of large employers. And then they say, and these flyers are like, hey, you're not getting your meal break in half an hour, come to us. And we'll get you some money. So, somebody gets fired, somebody's disgruntled, they're not happy with their employer. And so then they go to this attorney. And that attorney goes in there and says, oh, well, this must be a common practice for this employer. So we're going to make this a class action lawsuit. We want all the employees' time card information. And we're going to go out and represent them, whether they want to be represented or not, and then we're going to take 40% of their money. It's a scam. The whole thing is an entire scam. So now you've got, the legal profession complicating the process, introducing new torts, introducing new legislation to generate attorney fee revenue and money for these guys, what's next? Because they're hungry. These guys are so greedy and hungry for power and money. You know, what's next? Is vexatious litigation? The whole thing with no-fault divorce, it all came out of this desire to generate revenue for the legal profession.
Right, to simplify their ability to pick your pocket and basically make sure that you couldn't do these things for yourself by creating these what we'll call, you know, barriers or firewalls that, oh, you can't do this process. It's too convoluted. It's too difficult. Anyway, let's fast forward now. So you've, in our conversation this past weekend, you talked about using the First Amendment petition to removing either a committee or a few lawmakers. And so let's dive into that for a quick second here, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
So what happened? What did you do? And what happened to these people? Let's just kind of get the, you know, a 10,000-foot view of what you did, what you just recently did. And what time, how long ago was this that you went in there and removed this committee?
So, I went to the Supreme Court of the United States two times, I mentioned. And I'm like, what am I going to do now? So, I'm looking at this problem. How do we restore justice back to our courts? Because we can't have justice without fair courts. And you can't have fair courts without judicial accountability, without the check of one branch over the other of our judiciary. And today, there's no check or balance of power by one branch over the other of the judiciary, none whatsoever at all. So as I looked at this problem, I'm like, you know, how are we going to really just solve this once and for all? So I remonstrated. And I said, we've got a lot of corruption in the judiciary. But when you remonstrate, it's a petition for redress of grievance, right? So what's your redress? What do you want? You know, this is not a just an opportunity to go complain, because nobody wants to hear anybody complain. We want to hear about how to fix things that make things better. And so you have to seek, you know, it's a petition for redress. If you're not asking for redress and you're just complaining, they don't want to hear it. So what's the redress? I've got this complaint about corruption in the judiciary. What, you know, how are we going to fix that problem? Well, I had several recommendations I made to them. I want drug tests for judges. I spoke with 70 legislators. Without exception, every single one of them thought it was a great idea to drug test judges. I want live stream recorded court proceedings available on demand to the public. Transparency. I want cameras in the courtroom pointed at the judge so that the people can see, you know, how these guys bully and harass litigants in the courtroom. I want everybody handed a piece of paper that says you have a right of due process. And here's what due process means, and including you have a right to a trial by jury in civil cases, and you have a right to a fair and impartial judge. And if you don't have any, if you're denied that right of due process, then you have a right to petition for redress of grievance to your General Assembly. And among those reforms, the redress I was seeking is the abolishment of the Tennessee Board of Judicial Conduct. That agency was created in 1971 because we had an incredible problem with judicial corruption back in the late 60s and the early 70s. And the United States Congress enacted legislation to try to curtail that. That was bait and switch in the federal Congress. The states tried to at least give lip service, and they created these judicial oversight agencies. Two problems with that is judicial oversight is legislative power. It is in the state and federal constitution. The House has the sole power of impeachment. And who can be impeached is legislators, judges, presidents, governors, attorneys for the state. That's who can be impeached. And so impeachment is legislative power. And in the Tennessee Constitution, judges can be removed by concurrent vote of both houses. So clearly, in the Tennessee Constitution, judicial oversight is legislative power. So when they created this Board of Judicial Conduct, they made it up all judges. There's like 10 or 15 judges that are overseeing other judges. And what they did is when they created that agency, they usurped legislative power. The judiciary took legislative power upon themselves. The other problem is that the Tennessee Constitution says no judge shall hold any other office of trust or profit under this state or the United States. And that Board of Judicial Conduct is an office of trust.
Uh-huh.
Those judges are holding expressly prohibited offices of trust. And the founders, they did this it's in the federal constitution.
Sure.
It's the incompatibility clause, one person, one office.
Right.
And they did that because plural office holding always leads to corruption. You know, it was the English Whigs were constantly complaining, and the Whigs had great influence over the framers of our state and federal constitutions. So as part of the redress, I want them to abolish that agency. So that was a very long answer to your short question about what I did with this agency.
Okay.
Because of the complexity of my complaint, and what I, you know, I wanted them to just completely abolish this agency because they're, since 1971, they have never once recommended removal or impeachment of a single judge. And I use their own annual reports. They dismiss 100% of complaints. They're corrupt. They're criminals protecting criminals.
Right. So let me ask you this. So let me just inject real quick. In our previous conversation, I pointed out within the Constitution of the 14th Amendment, Section 3, they actually lowered the bar to take away the need for impeachment by creating a moral perjury clause that while you're under oath and you fail to do the basic of supporting the Constitution, then you're disqualified and must be removed. In other words, this is the fast track of getting rid of judges. It's the fast track of getting rid of any public servant who, by the requirement of office, must take an oath to the Constitution. So, in other words, county commissioners, state legislators, all different levels of judges and so forth and so on are now to be held by the standard that if they don't support the Constitution, they're disqualified and must be removed, and not only removed, but banned for life. So did you get a chance to look at that within the constitutional framework to say why they've simplified? We don't even have to go through the impeachment process.
The problem is there's nobody to bring it to. You know, you go to court and you know, file a civil suit, they won't do anything. You go to the FBI. You know, the FBI, their website says that judges have been granted tremendous power, and civil rights violations and abuses and from these corrupt judges is what is our premier investigative priority. The FBI says this is a premier investigative priority for them. They never once investigate corrupt judges.
So here's the question, though. This really boils it down. Is the Constitution the supreme law of the land?
The federal Constitution states explicitly that it is the supreme law of the land.
And so every amendment that is ratified by the states that becomes a part of that Constitution then becomes a part of the supreme law of the land.
Absolutely. But the law is not enforceable because government is absolutely corrupt, top to bottom.
Well, so,
the only way that we're going to correct that problem is if the people start coming together and getting loud.
Okay, so this goes back to the petition. Did you get a chance to look at the petition on our Reclaiming the Republic page?
I have not.
Probably not. Okay.
I skimmed some of it, yeah.
Okay, so the bottom line is that the initial petition was to remove Governor Inslee and Mayor Durkin for failing to support the Constitution while they were under oath, in essence, disqualifying themselves and demanding that they be removed from office, demanding that either they resign or be removed. And so, you know, we were pushing forward to try to get people to sign up for that. And unfortunately, it fell by the wayside because of politics and everything else. And I'll get into that more later. But The question is that now we have teeth within the Constitution that you can use with, let's say, your upper teeth and bottom teeth, the right of petition and the right of common law grand juries, along with this one section of the 14th Amendment, to start chewing up and spitting out this corruption. Does that make sense?
When I was in court, this was in a civil mandamus case. A mandamus petition for writ of mandamus is asking the court to order a state or government official to perform their duty. That's what a mandamus case is. They're asking a court to tell a government official to do their job. And in that case, tremendous corruption. But when I got to the Court of Appeals, the judge in there, although they denied me justice completely and they ignored corruption in the case, the judge in there gave me this law review article out of the Cincinnati Law Review. And that law review, it cited the Constitution, it cited a book, The Constitutional History of Medieval England. And what that law review article in The Constitutional History of Medieval England said is that common and frequent petitions, they used to be common, they used to be frequent. It took the place of prolonged discontent and a long list of grievances presented at the point of a sword. That's what petitions did. When they came out with the Magna Carta, the barons, and said, you know, we have to be able to petition you, King John. And he said yes, and then the Pope said no, and so they had the first barons war as a result of that. But they still, you know, ultimately, you know, adopted the provisions of the Magna Carta. And that's where this first became formalized, and then in the 1640s, the House of Commons determined that commoners have the right to prepare and present petitions. So a commoner in 1640 could go to Parliament in Great Britain and petition them for something. And these were common, and they were frequent, and they took the place of prolonged discontent and a long list of grievances at the point of a sword. That's what this right does. This right is how it discloses corruption and remedies it consequently. That's what this right does. It expresses the will of the people to government is what this right does. It is the foundation of our republican form of government, and it's so oppressed, it's been wiped from our collective knowledge. So, you know, as we look at all of these problems, the everything, literally everything that we do to try to restore justice, to express the sovereign will of the people, is going to prove futile until we can restore the right to petition for redress of grievance by address or remonstrance. Literally, because you can't, you know, if you don't have a voice, you know, raise your hand, and you don't have that publicity. Pacific Telephone and Telegraph. I said publicity is the crucial prophylactic aspect of justice. And justice done in any covert manner, in any dark corner, that does not seem correct, at best suggests the system isn't working, or at worst it's corrupt. You know, when you have the publicity of addressing a legislative house and saying that the people want something, they cannot deny justice in a case like that. So, you know, we have to, all of us, you know, whatever aspect of work, you know, Republican review, you know, how do we get that Republican review? Get the people behind it and remonstrate and cite them. We got to get the people stirred up, you know, to stand up for this right of petition. The people, you know, in the words of Cooley, The people are, they have become so servile and debased that they're unfit to exercise the privileges of free men. He's right. I mean, you know, you got people going out in Virginia protesting anti-gun legislation that they're coming out, and they have already been stripped their most powerful right. Now, all right, Gio, take this. This is a perfect example. If government just said you no longer have a right to bear arms, what do you think would happen?
I think that there would be people, because it's already been expressed, that there would be people that would either get organized and march upon government with their guns, and or they would basically say, well, come take them from, you know, my cold, dead hands, because you're not going to get my guns from me. And I always found it interesting how people like to cherry pick parts of the Constitution that they think is the most precious and the most important when, you know, I go, well,
perfect. I agree with you. Correct response. People are going to take up arms, or they're going to be like, yeah, come take it out of my cold, dead hands.
Right.
So the right of petition is far more powerful than the right to bear arms. The right to bear arms against a worthless government is, or the right to bear arms against a wrongful government is worthless. It is absolutely worthless today. I'll give you an example. I was a Force Recon Marine for 8 years, and I know how to fight. I know how to fight. I'm a small arms expert and a hand-to-hand expert. I know how to fight really well. If I had geared up and put on body armor and grabbed an AR-15, I don't even need fully automatic. Just give me a semi-automatic and 10-30 round magazine, and I would wreak havoc. And if I had done that, they could do nothing to justify my behavior. I would have no remedy that would justify what I did from the legislative houses. The media would portray me, you know, as a lunatic, and all of my work would have been for nothing. But instead, I went down there and I remonstrated, and I filed a written document, and I asserted my constitutional right. And even though they oppressed that right by not reading my petition and denying my right to address them, they removed every judge from the Tennessee Board of Judicial Conduct. They removed them from office. That is how powerful the right of petition is. And this is what I talk about with you know, Cooley, that Michigan Supreme Court justice back in the 1800s, that the right of petition, that it would seem unnecessary that they would even have to put that in the Constitution, because it is so essential to a Republican form of government. But it would seem impossible that it would be denied until the spirit of liberty has wholly disappeared. And for it to be denied, I would say that the spirit of liberty has wholly disappeared, and that the people have become servile and unfit to exercise any privileges of free men. And I will stand by that until the people will come and stand by me and say, we are going to restore the right of petition. Government is going to abide by the Constitution. Until the people at large do that, they are unfit to exercise the privileges of free men. Their most powerful constitutional right, the foundation of this republic, everything that this republic was founded on has been stripped from us, and they are laughing at us.
And so, folks, we had to cut it right there, and what we're going to do is we're going to go into a break. We're going to have some promos, but what I am going to do is I am going to, when I come back, kind of talk at a high level of the importance of education, educating people, who do we educate, and the different levels of the battlefield and interests in those battlefields. So we'll be right back after these promos, so please stay tuned. Thank you so much.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.